Hank Lobeer, and I'm standing in for Dr. Kennedy, who couldn't be here this evening. Welcome to another Saturday evening lecture at the Vancouver Institute. This evening, our speaker is Dr. Patricia Baird, acting head of the Department of Medical Genetics at UBC. Dr. Baird was born and had her schooling in England, and she then did her undergraduate work in Montreal at McGill and received her BSc and her doctorate of medicine there. She did her internship at the Royal Victoria Hospital, followed by a stint at the Vancouver General Hospital. She became a specialist in pediatrics and is a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada. She practiced as a pediatrician at the health center at the VGH. Since 1968, Dr. Baird has been on the staff of the Faculty of Medicine here at UBC. She's presently, as I said, the acting head of the Department of Medical Genetics. Dr. Baird has done extensive research and published an impressive number of papers, mostly in the field of genetics. She tells me that her interest in the subject came from her clinical practice in pediatrics. She would see children born with genetic abnormalities and realized what an effect these abnormalities had on the family of the child. Through her experience as a practicing doctor, a speaker, a researcher, and a teacher, she's eminently qualified to speak on the subject, heredity, and your family. Dr. Patricia Baird.
Thank you. Thank you. I think I might have to shorten this. Does it shorten at all, or is it?
Yeah, you can make it.
Good.
How's that?
I think it's still a little. Can you get it? Lovely, thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank the program committee for their generous invitation to me to talk tonight. I feel very honored to be in such illustrious company when I look at the rest of the year's program. When you say genetics these days, people immediately think of things like recombinant DNA, genetic engineering, cloning. Now, while these are important and fascinating topics, I hope you didn't come to hear about them because I'm not going to talk about them. It's my strong feeling that before we get off into the realm of such exotic phenomena, that we really ought to have a knowledge of the basic mechanisms of inheritance. There's enough there that's truly fascinating, and moreover with ramifications that right now are applicable to many families in BC. I'm pleased to see an increasing awareness of genetics and what it has to offer on the part of the general public as well as physicians. But I think it's a shame that the only sort of coverage human genetics seems to get in the press is that of a rather sensational variety. I would very much like to see what we already know now about genetics being applied to disease prevention. But part of that depends on having an informed public. Now, children in general resemble their parents, and I'd like to go over for you how nature brings this about. And it's every bit as intriguing and fascinating a topic as genetic engineering, and it should be part of the basic cultural armamentarium of everyone. As we go over the main patterns of inheritance, and I'm going to go over these one by one, and I hope we will have a slide here of the outline of what I'm going to talk about. As I go over these main patterns of inheritance that I've listed there, I'm going to outline for you how transmission of a disease in a family is relevant for that family, and we'll consider who is at risk of having affected children or not. I'll just have them partly down, please. I like to see people. Then I can see if people are going to sleep or not. I'll talk louder. I'm going to mention what medicine has to offer right now for people who are in these various categories. And I know that some of the people in the audience will have had a fair amount of genetics, but there will be also people who have had very little. So perhaps the people who know quite a lot will excuse me, because maybe it'll be a good review anyway. Okay, first of all, how important are genetic disorders? And I'd like to lay low an old shibboleth that says they're rare birds, because they are not. And this slide and the next slide should show a few statistics that emphasize that. They are not rare. And it's likely that a disorder that is at least partly genetically determined will impinge on the lives of everyone in this room, if not in ourselves, in the family, in someone close to us. What is the physical basis of heredity? How are the essential instructions passed on how to form and how to function? Now, if you look closely at the structure in the center of living cells, the nucleus, at certain stages you see darkly staining bodies, and these are the chromosomes. And this is a picture of human chromosomes. Now, these are the physical vehicles of inheritance, or you could put it another way, the blueprints for that individual. They're going to give instructions to that new human being how to develop, how to form. Now, humans have 46 chromosomes in every cell. And if you look carefully at these, there really are 46 there, and they're not 46 different ones. There are 23 pairs. And this next slide is got the pairs cut out and arranged neatly so you can see them. Now, 22 of those 23 pairs are alike. They're just the same as each other. And geneticists, being quite logical people, call them pair number one, pair number two, pair number three, etc. Until you come to the 23rd pair. Can you see this pointer all right? Anyway, down here, over in the corner, you see there's a pair of chromosomes that don't look like each other. Now, if this were a cell from a female, those two would look alike, and they would both be X chromosomes. But this is a cell from a male, and that chromosome pair looks different. There's one X chromosome and one Y chromosome. And again, we're logical people, so we call that pair of chromosomes the sex chromosomes. Now, obviously, if we want to look at somebody's chromosomes, we've got to have a sample of cells. And the easiest set of cells to get from anyone is to just draw a few cc's of their blood, and then we grow the white cells that are in the blood. And these chromosome pictures that you see here that I've shown you are taken from the white cells that are grown up from someone's blood sample. Now, we all know that a new human being results from the joining of two cells, an egg and a sperm. So why is it then that the new human being doesn't have 92 chromosomes if human cells have 46? Well, what happens is a very elegant and neat mechanism called meiosis. And in this, there's a cell division, a special kind of cell division that occurs only in those cells that are going to give rise to eggs or to sperm. And what happens here is that the chromosomes, and I've only drawn two pairs here of chromosomes so that it will simplify things for you. Here, the chromosomes line up in the middle of the cell, each chromosome with its pair. And then what separates are the members of the pair. The pairs disjoin, the cell wall comes around, and you get two groups of 23 chromosomes, and then the cells that result from those have the fully formed eggs and sperm have 23 chromosomes, one member of each pair. So that when you get an egg and a sperm joining together, you get 46 chromosomes again, one member of each pair of chromosomes from mother, one member of each pair of chromosomes from father. And really, it's very pretty. Now, so we know how we get the right normal human number of chromosomes then. How is sex determined? Okay. Now, you can see that if this division of chromosomes is going to go on into two neat groups. If you are a woman, this is not a very good pointer, but if you are a woman, there are two X's in all your cells, and the cell that gives rise to the eggs can only give X's into those eggs, so that's all that can be provided in the eggs. A man, when he makes sperm, half of the sperm on the average will have a Y and half will have an X. So that whether you have a boy or a girl depends totally on whether the sperm was bearing a Y chromosome or an X chromosome. And that really is quite simple too. So what I've tried to do so far is give you a very brief, simple idea of what the normal situation is in human beings and how we get 46 chromosomes and how sex is determined. What I'm going to now go on to do is talk about what goes wrong. Now, when something goes wrong with the normal process of this, you can get human beings who have not the normal number of chromosomes, but who have too many or too few. And this is the first of the major categories of disorder I've outlined over on this side, chromosomal disorders. Now, as you may remember from our first slide, 1 in 200 newborn children have a chromosome problem. And I'm going to talk first about conditions where something has gone wrong involving the non-sex chromosomes, the autosomes. Now, by far the most common chromosome problem in British Columbia and in anywhere in the world, and it occurs about once in every 630 births, is Down syndrome, or mongolism as it used to be called. These individuals we all recognize because they look different. They all tend to have very recognizable characteristics, and I think you will be familiar with some of these as I go through the slides. They rather unusual shaped eyes and the whole facial gestalt. This is another young girl who has Down syndrome. And this shows the rather short brachycephalic head, rather low set primitive ear, and the flat facial profile. And this is another girl who shows the epicanthic fold that you often get on the medial aspect of the eye, and again the whole facial gestalt, and she in addition has strabismus. Now, all these children tend to have similar physical findings. They tend to be short, they tend to have small round heads, and when we start looking at them in detail, we will find that there are a number of characteristics that they have which are unusual in normal people. For example, on examination of the hands, you will find very often, if you look at your own palm and fold it slightly across, you'll usually see two transverse lines. If there is just one transverse line, as you can see in that fingerprint, that's called a simian crease. Don't panic if you look down and you see one, because there are a small proportion of normal people who have a simian crease. Another thing that you look for in these children is a short incurved fifth digit, just like mine. And again, this is something that you see in very unusually in normal people, but which is very frequent in Down syndrome. As you go through a checklist of physical findings in Down syndrome, and the usual list we use, Hall's list, has over 20 of these, you find you're ticking them off more and more. We are able, with a very high degree of accuracy, to make a diagnosis of whether a child, even in a newborn, has Down syndrome or not. And even in a newborn child, this is a diagnosis which you can make. This child looks rather unusual because its head's been shaved, but this is a very characteristic flat facial profile, small crumpled ear, and there are other things typical about it when you were able to see that baby. Okay. Now, as well as looking different, children who have Down syndrome have two other problems. And the first and the most heartbreaking thing that they have is that they are retarded. For the majority of them, the IQ level falls somewhere between 25 and 50, and it's this aspect that needs special resources and special support for them. The other problem that I mentioned that these children have is in a fairly high frequency, about 4 out of 10 of them have congenital heart disease. Now, in British Columbia, every year there are between 50 and 60 children born who have Down syndrome. Now, why do they all have the same problems in common? They all have the same problems because they all have an extra chromosome number 21. And it's this extra chromosome material that interferes with their normal development. It's present in every cell, and it's what causes them to resemble each other, perhaps more than their own families. Well, if all these children have an extra chromosome 21, how did they get it? Now, obviously, if you think about it, in the separation of the chromosomes to give rise to two packages of 23, if one of them lagged behind, you could get an egg or a sperm formed which had an extra chromosome. If that egg is fertilized or that sperm fertilizes that has the extra chromosome, you get a new human being who doesn't have the normal 46. They have 47 chromosomes. And if it's the 21st pair that didn't disjoin properly, then you've got a child who has an extra 21. Now, you saw on that previous picture I showed you of the chromosomes that we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. This failure to disjoin normally can occur in any one of those chromosome pairs. If it happens to one of the larger chromosomes, it seems that this large amount of extra material is not compatible with life, and those conceptions end up as early miscarriages. Or later miscarriages, depends which one. But if it happens to one of the smaller chromosome pairs, then it may be compatible with life. And Down syndrome I'm just using as the most common example. There are several other syndromes that we recognize. The others are all more severe and associated with multiple malformations and severe mental retardation. Now, is there any way we can prevent this happening or have any sort of a predictive test? Well, although this failure to separate nicely into packages of 23 can happen to anyone, we do know that an interesting thing is that it's more likely to happen to you the older you are. And this is a graph from British Columbia data which simply shows that the age of the mother is along this axis, and along this is the likelihood of having a child with Down syndrome. And you can see that from about the mid-30s, a person's risk of having a child with Down syndrome, a woman's risk, goes up very markedly. Now, what can we offer then to a woman who is, say, 40 and pregnant, or to a couple who've already had one child with Down syndrome? Because the other interesting observation is that if a couple have had a child with a chromosome anomaly of this type, they're more likely to have it happen to them again. Well, what can we offer those older couples or couples who've had a child previously like this? Well, we can offer amniocentesis. Now, amniocentesis is a procedure whereby a small amount of fluid is withdrawn from inside the womb. Now, in this fluid, there are cells which are derived from the baby. And we simply take those cells and grow them and look at them in the same way as the blood chromosomes that I described earlier. And we can see, in this particular case, we're interested in looking at the sample we take off for chromosomes, because the woman is older, is at risk of a chromosomal problem. We can look at the fluid we take off in different ways, but in this particular case, we'd be looking at the cells for chromosomes. And we do this test at about 15 to 16 weeks gestation, and it's on an outpatient basis. The placenta or afterbirth is located using an ultrasound scanner, and the fetus is checked to make sure it's the right size and shape for the gestational age it should be. Then we take the fluid and examine it. If we find an extra chromosome 21, then we know that fetus has Down syndrome. If we find one of the other ones, we know what the syndrome is depending on the chromosomal finding. The family can then elect, if they wish, to have a therapeutic termination of that pregnancy. This option, this prenatal detection and termination, is something which is a very individual thing. For many families, it's a boon, and it's an option that makes it possible for them to go on and continue a pregnancy or to go on and have a family. For others, depending on their religious or ethical beliefs, it's not a viable alternative. So I want to emphasize that this is something which is a very individual thing, but which we offer as an option to anyone who is at higher risk. Now, I've talked then about the most common condition when something's gone wrong with the chromosomes. But as you can imagine, it is theoretically possible, and in practice we do see it, for a small part of any one of the chromosomes to be missing or to be extra. And it gives rise to a whole host of other chromosomal conditions, which I don't have time to go into. But it does explain why some children have developmental problems and are retarded and small. These other events, these extra bits or deletions, bits missing, are often accidental, sporadic, one-of-a-kind things and not likely to happen again in that family. But that can be very reassuring information to a couple who are worried because they've got a handicapped child and they want to know the chance of it happening again. It can be just as reassuring to realize it's not going to happen again with any likelihood. So I've discussed briefly the things that can go wrong with the autosomes, the non-sex chromosomes. I'm now going to touch on those things that can go wrong involving the pair of sex chromosomes. Now, as you remember, a boy has an X and a Y, and a girl has two X's in her cells. The first condition I want to mention where something has gone wrong with the sex chromosomes is Turner syndrome. And this occurs in a girl who is missing at least part of her second X and at least part of her cells. It usually has the sequela that she is quite short. And the way these girls come to attention very often as children is because of the shortest kid in the class, sometimes of the shortest kid even if they're compared to the grade behind them. They're usually of normal intelligence, but the trouble is that females need two normal X's in their cells for their ovaries to complete normal development. So it means that when puberty comes and the ovaries should start putting out hormones and cause breast development and periods, this doesn't happen to these girls. And therefore, almost all of them will come to attention at that time. Now, the treatment of that is relatively simple in that we can simply give the hormones that her own ovary would have made. But the two things that usually girls who have this condition have to come to terms with are their shortness of stature and the fact that they usually cannot have children because the ovary is not developed enough that it's able to put out eggs. So those are the two things that they have to come to terms with. The other condition that we commonly encounter where something has gone awry with the sex chromosome pair is Klinefelter syndrome. And here, this is in a boy where he's got at least some extra X material in at least some of his cells. Now, having this extra X that boys don't usually have interferes with the normal maintenance and development of the testis. So it means usually when he grows up, he tends to be low in testis function. Now, one can give testosterone for that. Trouble is, if there are more extra X's, these boys tend to be retarded. Probably any young boy who's functioning on a slow or mildly retarded level ought to have his chromosomes looked at because it would be interesting to see if this were the explanation because it's not that rare. It occurs about 1 in 500 males. Now, the last two conditions, the Turner and the Klinefelter that I've mentioned to you, are not familial. They don't recur again in a family. And that, again, is useful information for the people concerned. Now, So far, I've discussed the normal and then what can go wrong as far as chromosomes are concerned. And you can see this is usually going to affect the child in the way of physical growth or malformations or intelligence. Many of these conditions that I've mentioned are sporadic with a low recurrence risk, but some of them have a high recurrence risk, and we can pick out individuals who have a higher risk in some of these, and we can offer them prenatal detection. Now, chromosomes are things that we can see and we can count. We have ways of studying them and looking at them and seeing that something's gone wrong. What I'm going to go on and talk about now, the next group of disorders over on this side, are problems due to having aberrant genes. Now, genes are extremely small. For practical purposes, they are so small we cannot see them. They're the units of inheritance that are carried on the chromosomes, and they are what ultimately give the instructions how to form and how to function. And perhaps a rather simple but useful analogy would be to think of a chromosome as a string of beads, and each bead is a gene, and the string of beads is the chromosome. Now, human beings probably have somewhere around at least 100,000 genes each. All of the conditions that I'm going to talk about, and I've grouped them into these categories, are due to abnormal genes. We cannot see the gene, as I said, and we can't look at it. Usually, we can simply see the effect of having that wrong instruction the gene has given to the body. In some cases, we can test for the biochemical product that it makes. Sometimes we just have to rely on an abnormal physical finding that results from the gene having given the wrong instructions. Now, you'll remember that chromosomes came in pairs. Because genes are integral parts of chromosomes, they too have to come in pairs. So, when we're considering any particular gene pair, you've got one from the mother and one from the father. And there are three main patterns of single gene inheritance, which I've listed here. And I'm going to go over each one of them and show you what it means for a family in terms of recurrence risk if they have a disorder inherited in one of these ways. And I'll also try to outline at the end of each of these topics what's available in the way of diagnosis and prevention. Now, the first pattern of inheritance that I'd like to discuss is dominant inheritance. Now, if the gene for a dominant disorder is a dominant, you only have to have one dose of this to show the disorder. And what does this mean for a family? Well, you can see here, the pointer is pointing here at the left-hand side at the top. This individual will be affected, that capital D stands for the dominant disease-causing gene. Half the sperm will have that, or eggs, and half the eggs or sperm will have the other. And when you see the possible ways that this can link up with the eggs or sperm formed by the partner, who we'll assume is perfectly normal, because having a dominant gene is a rather unusual thing, you'll see it's kind of like flipping a coin. Is it 50-50? Are you going to have the dominant disease-causing gene go into that gamete, or are you going to have the normal one? So if you're considering disorders that fall into this category, the risk to have an affected child is 50%. And what I'm going to do is show you a few representative disorders, and I can only show you a few representative disorders because there's well over 700 of these conditions definitely known and another 700 that are strongly suspected to be dominant. So we can't see them all. That's just really another way of showing what I've said. This young lady has a dominant disorder called tuberous sclerosis. The only unusual thing you will see in her are these lesions on her skin. But this disorder leads to seizures often and to mental retardation in a fair percentage of cases. This young man has a dominant disorder called Waardenburg syndrome, which leads to the eyes looking to be spaced far apart, a white forelock, But the thing that's most cogent here is the fact that also a high proportion have deafness with this. This slide I put in to remind us all that genetic disorders have been with us as long as mankind has existed. And this interesting-looking gent with the monkey on his shoulder has got achondroplasia, which is a dominant disorder. Now, actually, individuals who had this were really looked on as being rather special for a lot of history and kept as sort of oddities at courts in Europe. And here is a modern-day boy who has achondroplasia. Now, if we look at a family pedigree where a dominant disorder is occurring, you'll see that characteristically it's transmitted, the squares are males, the circles are females, it's transmitted characteristically from generation to generation. And if you look at an affected person, they usually have an affected parent. It gets a little more risky when you get sort of four generations back, because knowing whether indeed that person was deaf or had a white forelock four generations ago, it's not many of us can get back that far with a high degree of certainty. Maybe there's a few can. Okay. Now, what then can we do for these families who have a dominant disorder? Well, really, in dominant disorders, we can give them accurate recurrence risk advice. There are present just a few disorders that we can detect in utero which are dominant, but this number is increasing, and there are some very interesting techniques being worked out which should make many more of them possible over the next few years. So, this is an area which we can detect some prenatally and which is rapidly growing, and we can give accurate recurrence risk advice. Now, the next main category of inheritance, which is up here, is recessive. And I think it is the most fascinating, really. It's the one that accounts for a lot of humankind's variation. And it's one that usually families, medical students, sometimes even physicians have difficulty understanding is genetic. What I'm talking about with recessive inheritance is, again, a category that has a lot of representative diseases in it. There are well over 500 disorders definitely known to be inherited in a recessive way, and almost an equal number suspected to be so. Now, some examples that you might be familiar with are cystic fibrosis, which is the most common recessive disorder in our society. It's a chronically handicapping lung condition. Many kinds of deafness are recessive. Certain types of microcephaly, which this child has with retardation. Albinism is another one, and you can see the two adults in that picture both have albinism. This is a little child who has Fanconi's anemia, another recessive, which often is associated with malformations of the upper limb, and which goes on to very often to become neoplastic. This gentleman, if you count his fingers, you see there's something not quite right, and he's also actually quite short. He's quite dwarfed. He has something called the Alice Van Creveld syndrome. Another example is phenylketonuria, and this little girl has that. And individuals who have this are unable to process normally an amino acid that's present in milk and in our diet. The amino acid then builds up in their blood and it causes retardation. Now, knowing that a baby has this particular autosomal recessive gene makeup, the environment is changed for the baby so that the usual consequence of retardation does not follow. We simply remove most of that amino acid from the baby's diet and thus prevent retardation. And most of the children who are treated early with this do very well. Now, in this category of disorder, recessive, for somebody to be affected, with it. They have to inherit the unusual recessive gene from both parents. They have to have a double dose. If you see over there in the right, they have to have a double dose of this gene so that they have no normal gene covering for it and giving the normal right instructions. So you see that if someone has a disorder like this, it means that both parents have to be carriers for it. There's no other way they could get it. So both parents are carrying it. They themselves are perfectly normal. We shouldn't really be sitting here feeling smug about these people that are carrying it, because all of us carry at least one or two recessive genes that, if they were present in double dose, would cause a problem. So that all that has happened here is these two individuals, by chance, are carrying the exact same one out of their 100,000, are carrying the exact same one, and it's got together here in that child. But you can see, once that's happened, once that couple have identified for us that they are both carrying the same recessive gene, we know that their recurrence risk in future pregnancies is 25%. It's one in four of having the same thing happen again. Now, why medical students and others have, and families particularly, have trouble understanding this as genetic, for example, that the child is deaf because it's a recessive disorder, is because there is no one else in the family affected, usually. And when you think about it for a minute, that's exactly what you would expect. Because the only other place you would see it in the family would be in a brother or a sister. And that was okay in the Victorian times, when people had a dozen and you could take the odds, you really had a pretty good chance of it coming up more than once. But I think the average family in Canada now is something like 2.2 children. So usually these will be one case in a family. And it's been estimated that on the average, with random mating, it takes about 8 generations for that recessive to show up again. And most of us cannot go back 8 generations. When I'm taking a family history, I'm lucky if I get 4 or 5. So that most of us would not be aware of it, even if it had happened at that remove in our family. So usually, when we take a family history on a recessive disorder, unless there is a sib affected, there is no one else in the family who has that disorder. And of course, it's psychologically very difficult for that family to realize then that it is genetic. Okay, what can we do for families who fit into this category? Well, apart from giving them the rather dismal news that it's a 1 in 4 recurrence risk when they have future pregnancies, for an increasing number of conditions now, it's almost 100 conditions that fit into this category, we can do specific prenatal testing. We can do an amniocentesis, as I described before, but instead of looking at the cells, we will do a specific biochemical test looking for the disorder that we're concerned with. Now, this is a real boon for a couple who may be caring for a chronically handicapped child and who would like to have further family, but who really feel they couldn't face the prospect of caring for another seriously handicapped child. Or for a couple who've had the heartbreak of seeing a baby with an autosomal recessive disorder progressively deteriorate, go downhill, and die at 5 or 6 years of age. With this diagnostic test available in pregnancy, it allows many couples to have a healthy family. And in fact, there's even one disorder actually where prenatal treatment is effective for a disorder. One thing that's perhaps worth mentioning is the question that's sometimes asked about brothers or sisters. Now, obviously, brothers or sisters of an affected person, let's say this child had cystic fibrosis or phenylketonuria, whatever you want, the brothers or sisters have a high chance of being a carrier. They have a 2/3 chance of being a carrier. But their chance of marrying a carrier of the same thing is usually quite low, unless it's a very common carrier rate in the population. And then when you multiply it as well as by the carrier rate, by the 1 in 4 chance of getting those two genes together, you get down to a very low risk, quite acceptable for most people, usually of the order of 1 in several hundred.
What about a cousin marriage?
That's a different thing. It's a special thing. If we have time at the end, maybe we'll go into that. This I've just put up to show you some representative autosomal recessive disorders, and this is data on BC, and incidentally, you wouldn't be able to put a table like this upon on your own population very many places in the world. We're very, very lucky in this province to have the Health Surveillance Registry, which means that we're able to have data like this available to us. And there are the carrier rates in our population, in BC, in recent years, of those particular types. And that's information which is very useful to us. It's not sort of esoteric information. If a family comes in and wants to know their risk of having a child, we can use that carrier statistic that we've derived from the population in counselling them. So, now, one other thing that perhaps is worth... that's just another way of showing the same thing. Sometimes... people who aren't very knowledgeable about genetics suggest that perhaps there ought to be a program to decrease the number of carriers of genetic disorders in our population. And I always hear this statement with a little bit of dismay, because each and every one of us here carries some genetic disorder. And I'd really hate to see a program to eradicate the human race just so that we could come up to somebody's idea of genetic purity. I think here I'd like to make the point that it's our genetic variability, these oddball genes that occur in our population, that give us our reservoir as a species to adapt to change. If our environment changes, we may need those genes. And it can also be that a carrier who is just carrying one of these genes may have an advantage in some cases. And we have very good examples of that. I think we need our genetic load. It may be quite useful at some point in the future. And I think we don't know enough at the present time to get directive on any kind of large-scale programs. But I think that's quite a different matter than giving planning and accurate, concerned advice to the individual family who has a high risk of a specific disorder. Now, I've covered then the dominant and recessive types of inheritance, and we now come to another fascinating one, X-linked recessive inheritance. And a good example of this is shown... This was a pedigree of the recessive, what I was just talking about before. And that just shows you don't see it any place in the family except in brothers and sisters, usually. The other thing you do tend to see, though, because where you find the same rare gene, of course, is in that family. And you tend to see children who have recessive disorders come from the offspring of related marriages more often than you'd expect. Okay, that was just showing the same thing. Now here, this just shows you that nobody's immune. That lady up at the top is Queen Victoria, and Queen Victoria was a carrier for haemophilia, and I don't think she would have been amused. In X-linked recessive disorders, we have kind of a slightly different, a little more tricky thing, and I'm going to go over this again because it's a special case. Now, as you remember, females have two X's. That means that they may be normal. They may, both genes on both of the X's that we're considering may be normal, or if they have a recessive gene causing a problem, then they may be a carrier, but they will have the normal gene on the pair chromosome to make up for it. So a woman can be normal or she can be a carrier. It's a different situation in a man because he's only got one X. So whatever genes on that X is uncovered. There's nothing on the Y that's going to do the work for it and cover it up. So if a man's X has the normal gene, then he is normal. If he has the recessive gene, it will be uncovered and it will show and he will be affected. So men can have an X-linked recessive disorder or they can be normal, but they can't carry it. Now, if you look at a family where this sort of disorder is being transmitted, you'll find that you have males who are affected then for the reason I just gave, and they're always related to each other through carrier females. Now, what is the risk for a woman of having affected children if she is a carrier of an X-linked recessive disorder? And let's consider muscular dystrophy. This young man has Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is an X-linked recessive disorder, just as hemophilia is, just as 100 other disorders are definitely known to be, and quite a few others are suspected to be. Let's just consider what the position would be for the carrier sister of that young man. And remember, this young woman may have seen her brother go into a wheelchair by the time he's 10, be completely bedridden and incapacitated by the time he's 20 with this disease. And so it's not something that she's going to take lightly. So the thing here is that that woman who's at the top here at the left, if she's a carrier, she takes the risk of having children with her. Whoever she marries, it doesn't matter, because the male in this is almost irrelevant. Because you can see that if she has a girl, the girl can be perfectly normal, or the girl could be a carrier. And those chances are equally likely. So if she has a girl, it's a 50% chance that girl will be a carrier, but the girl will be normal herself. If, however, she has a boy, you can see that if the sperm that carries the Y fertilizes an X that has the dystrophy gene, then that boy is going to be affected. If it fertilizes the other X, she's going to have a normal boy. However, if she has a boy, she has a 50% risk of having a boy with muscular dystrophy. And it's same for all the X-linked conditions, X-linked mental retardation, you name it, the risks are the same. Now, that's kind of an awful position to be in for the girls who are in this family. And so I'd like to go over what we can do for individuals with the disorder not be at risk at all. We can do, for some of the disorders, carrier detection tests to see if indeed that girl is a carrier or is a normal. And we can offer for some of these conditions to detect by prenatal diagnosis an affected male fetus. Even in those conditions where we are not yet smart enough to see if the fetus is affected, we can offer amniocentesis for sexing. If a woman has a risk of any male she has having a 50% risk of having a serious disorder, such as the ones I've mentioned, then she and her husband may feel that it's a viable option for them, that rather than take that high risk, they would rather have a termination. Now, that then is X-linked recessive disorders. We're getting there. The next category I'm going to talk about now is multifactorial disorders. And a multifactorial disorder is one which is determined by several sets of genes from both parents, and they're additive in nature. Each gene has a small effect on the characteristic we're thinking of, and as well, in many cases, there's probably some environmental input. Now, what kinds of things are we talking about? Well, most of the common malformations that we see at birth, and I'm talking about things such as cleft lip and palate and a spina bifida type of defects where the nervous system, the spinal column, has not closed over normally. And of course, these children often have problems with not being able to walk or having bowel and bladder dysfunction. Club foot. And there are quite a number of other examples of this. It isn't confined just to birth defects, because there are several adult disorders that are thought to fit into this kind of category. Things like some types of diabetes mellitus, hypertension, schizophrenia, some forms of epilepsy, quite a number of things. Unfortunately, once a couple have had a child that falls into this category, Although the risk in the next pregnancy for a child with a similar congenital malformation is low, it's still definitely up from the general population risk, and it's usually of the order of somewhere around several percent. Now, unfortunately, too, people always feel very sympathetic and very empathic with people who've just had a child with a congenital malformation. And sometimes they will give well-meaning but highly inaccurate advice like lightning never strikes twice, you know, the best thing is to start all over again as soon as you can. Now this, it's all very well to go ahead and embark on a pregnancy, knowing, let's say, a 1 in 20 chance you may end up caring for a handicapped child again. But it's quite another to go ahead thinking you're in the clear and then it happens to you. So I would make a plea that if any couple have a child who has a congenital malformation, that they deserve to have accurate and well-considered counseling advice. What can we offer to people then who've had a child who fits into one of these multifactorial categories? Well, we can at least give them as accurate as is available, an empiric risk, so that they know roughly how high the risk is. Is it 1 in 100? Is it 5 in 100? Is it 10 in 100? And we can offer for some of them prenatal testing. For example, in that spina bifida type of defect that I just showed you, we can do an amniocentesis, and there again, and this time we're looking at the fluid we draw off, not for the cells and not for a specific other defect, but we're looking at the level of a protein, alpha fetoprotein, which is spilled out of the open defect in the neural system, and is at a higher than normal level in the fluid sample that we take off. And this will detect more than 95% of open neural tube defects, so that this is something we have to offer for some of these categories of malformation. Now, I've now covered the major types of inheritance and what medicine has to offer to people in the various categories. And I think you can see that the people who, sort of beforehand, should get some advice about the risks are those couples who are older, those couples who've had a history of a family problem, maybe they've had one or two deaf people or someone, a cousin or two cousins who are retarded, where there's some problem occurring more than once in the family, parents who have some family history of a disorder, even if it's only in one person, which is known to be a genetic disorder, and parents who've had a child already with a birth defect. So those are the sorts of people that we would like very much to see. Now, I'd like to conclude really by talking for a minute or two about our concepts of disease. We seem to look on disease as an outside enemy, and we talk about it in terms of war. We talk, for example, about the campaign against VD, our breakthroughs in chemotherapy, our conquering infection, battling killer diseases. It really sounds very exciting, and it has a very graphic quality, and it has a certain use to think of diseases like this, as long as the causes of disease are outside ourselves. Now, in the past, this was true, and in third world countries and developing countries where they're still having to contend with infections and malnutrition, this is still true. The problem is, I think, that there's an inherent danger to think that way about ill health if we apply it to the disorders that beset us in this day and age in our society now, because the common diseases now for us have important genetic components. For example, 20% of the people who have early heart disease, that is below 60, will be found to have a single gene-determined cause for that. The same is true for many of the other chronic health problems that we face. So that if we continue in this metaphor of waging war on disease, we're going to end up waging war on ourselves. And I think a better concept to replace this rather bellicose approach with would be one which has great appeal for many people, I think, once they have worked in biology at all. And that would be to emphasize the profound genetic individuality of each one of us. We're all genetically different. Every single one of us in this room is completely different than everyone else. And one of the most striking things about studying biology is the profound biological variation that exists between people. And this isn't just in morphological characteristics, say we all have a different face. If you take our fingerprints, they're under close genetic control. No two people in this room or in the world have the same fingerprints. Not only are we so diverse in those morphological characteristics, but our enzyme systems, we have an incredible number of polymorphisms, and each one of us is unique. We've all got slightly different metabolic machinery, and we're all adjusted slightly differently to our common environment. Now, this means when you consider any particular disease, our susceptibility to it is going to be very personal. And any one of you, your susceptibility to a disease that we consider in particular may be quite different than the neighbor sitting next to you. Now, prediction of our own personal health risks and then prevention of those risks will only be possible when our own genetic individuality is seen as the potential origin of disease. And I think we have to reorient our thinking because we can't make war on ourselves. We need to change the popular idea of disease. When I see collective campaigns that perceive everyone as being at the same risk, I worry that the health message is directed at the general population. Nobody feels vulnerable, so no one tends to do anything about it. It tends to be ignored. We should all jog. We should all eat less saturated fats. We should all smoke. If it's directed at everybody, nobody feels vulnerable, and it tends not to get done. The chances of somebody complying with a preventive measure, for example, giving up smoking or following a particular diet, it seems to me it would be much greater if we could identify people who have a particular risk from that exposure because of their individual genetic susceptibility. One man's meat truly is another man's poison. I think the other important thing to note, that, and maybe one reason why people have shied away from thinking about this, is that too often in the past people have felt that, well, if you have a genetic susceptibility to a particular disorder, that means you're doomed. It simply means that we have to learn to manipulate that individual's environment, their specific environment, so that the genotype is not expressed. And I gave you one good example with PKU, with phenylketonuria, where you simply remove the offending amino acid as much as possible. And in the future, I would hope that we'll move to a more individual health profile so that the opportunity for prevention could be taken on an individual basis. I hope you'll see now why I haven't discussed the glamorous topics of genetic engineering and gene cloning. I think there's more than enough fascinating and relevant information which is it's possible to apply and is being applied right now in the families we see who come from all over British Columbia. And I do hope that the popular notion of genetics and its esoteric nature will change. And I hope that the real relevance and the practical applications that knowledge of human genetics has to offer to families will come to be better understood by everybody. Thank you. How long the time was about right?
We now have time for questions. Please speak clearly and keep it short. And I've asked Dr. Baird to repeat the gist of the question for those of us that won't be able to hear.
Yes.
Exactly when you have to stop, there's been a lot of controversy about. I see Dr. Wolf is here in the audience, but it has to be kept on for many years. It probably differs somewhat for the particular enzyme defect you're talking about. It's probable that for certain enzyme defects, there are other systems that mature and are stimulated and can partly take over. But for many of them, if it's an absolutely crucial enzyme and there's no alternative pathway, it may indeed be that the therapy would have to be lifelong. Yes, there's a the question was, I mentioned that being a heterozygote, having just one dose, being a carrier for a disease, could be an advantage. And I was asked, could I give an example? Well, there's a disorder which results in an abnormal hemoglobin, sickling cell disease. And if you have two doses of that abnormal gene, you are sick, you are chronically anemic, and you are very ill. If, however, you are simply a carrier, it means nothing in our part of the world, but in many parts of Africa where falciparum malaria is endemic, it means that you tend not to die of it, which is a pretty good advantage.
Yes. Could you say anything about genetic effects and risk of carcinoma?
Yes, that's a huge topic, and I'd love to be invited to speak on it for about an hour. For any type of cancer that you can name, there are subgroups which are inherited in a Mendelian way. For example, you can think of families where breast cancer is inherited in that particular family, it looks like a Mendelian dominant. But for most of the common cancers, there's a familial clustering in that the risk of first degree relatives of having the same type of cancer is usually several times of that of the general population risk. So if you've got a family history of a particular type of cancer, your risk of having that is up. But you have to take an individual family history to be able to give more specific advice. It's a fascinating thing because there are so many disorders where you can have predisposition to cancers of various kinds. I just better shut up because it's such a big topic. Is it possible today to get individual genetic profiles done when there's no particular reason? No, not to be practical, in that there are four clinicians of us in the province who are trained to do this kind of work, and there's 2.5 million people, so it wouldn't be possible. For most of the time, as I've said, if you have a family history of something that seems to be a problem, then it's worth asking about. Otherwise, it's not practical.
Yes. Can you tell me what root Pompe's disease is and also
its cure for you? Pompe's disease, I think, is glycogen storage disease type 1. It's either type 1 or type 2, and it's alpha... God, what's the enzyme? Anyway, it's an autosomal recessive disorder that means a child stores glycogen. It usually has its onset soon after birth, and the child usually dies between around 2, sometimes less, occasional survivals to about 4, of heart failure and pneumonia usually. There's a recurrence risk of 1 in 4. There is no known cure. There is now a prenatal test available. We have to send the amniotic fluid sample away to Chicago to get it done, and it's a bit of a dicey thing because it may not get back again to us under 20 weeks, but we do it. I have done it for a family about 2 years ago.
Gentleman up there.
Charcot-Marie-Tooth, are there any advances in knowledge about Charcot-Marie-Tooth? Charcot-Marie-Tooth is an interesting disorder, which is a weakness and wasting of the muscles starting in the lower limb and being progressive. It's an interesting disorder genetically because there are several types of it. There's the commonest type is there's the autosomal dominant one. There is a recessive one, and there's an X-linked recessive one. And in fact, I think there are two families described where there's a variant of that. There's two different ones within that. It's something which we can now detect in the dominant if somebody actually has it more easily than we used to be able to by doing EMGs and other specific tests, so that if somebody has a parent who's affected, they themselves are 18 or 19, they're going to have children, but they want to know, well, will I pass this on? I don't seem to be affected, but I'm not sure, because it has a range of onset in the dominant kind. There are now better tests available to say if indeed they have the gene or not. Does that answer your question? Sorry. Come down afterwards.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly the children who have Down syndrome will...
Question.
Oh, sorry, the question. Would I like to comment on the level of retardation of children with Down syndrome who have intervention? Is that a good summary? Children with Down syndrome are basically human beings like all of us, and they will respond to stimulation and love and affection the same way any other child will. If you put a lot of effort and help and love and nurturing and stimulation into a child with Down syndrome, they will do better. And in the past, I think children with Down syndrome, people have often, even physicians used to advise, his child will be better off in an institution. And these children never used to get stimulated and were not able to develop to the optimum that they had the potential for. Nowadays, with infant stimulation programs and various helping agencies in the communities, children who have Down syndrome do an awful lot better than they used to. They still are retarded, but they certainly function at a better level than we used to be led to believe.
Yes. Yes, go ahead, Ms.
Mm-hmm. Sure. We've had quite a lot of information recently on the effect of alcohol and cigarettes on babies. Now, there is no doubt about the fact that if a woman is a chronic alcoholic and drinks through her pregnancy, she has a high risk of having a baby who shows the findings of the fetal alcohol syndrome. The extent of that risk, I think, is somewhere around 40% of women who continue to drink. The fetal alcohol syndrome is a baby who is small, with a small head, particular kind of facies, particular sorts of malformations, and is slow in development. So it's not something to be taken lightly. Now, we know from lab animals that there is a dose curve that you can go back, so that there is even quite a low level of alcohol will cause malformations in a few of the mice or the rats whose mothers are given this. We obviously can't do this in people, so we are still looking for and still trying to find out what a safe level is of alcohol during the pregnancy, because it affects the development of the fetus. I would suggest if anybody is in the reproductive age group and is planning a pregnancy that they're better off not drinking, simply because we really don't know what the safe level is. Is it two drinks a day? Can you go on a binge and then lay off? I mean, we just don't know. So it seems to me when you're dealing with something which may end up in a child who is slow, you live with that for the next 20 years, you're better off doing without a drink for a few months. Smoking certainly will decrease the birth weight of babies. And if you have babies who are born smaller, they tend to have more problems. They have a less good chance in life. There is some early evidence out that there may be malformations associated with smoking also, but this is not really very hard, big evidence yet.
Yes, madam.
Yes, if you say an allergy is someone who manifests either eczema or hay fever or asthma, any one of that triad, 18% of the general population will show one of those during their life. If you look at the offspring of people who have a history of allergy, double that in their children will show an allergy. The question that's most often asked is usually about asthma. For example, if a couple have a child who is a severe asthmatic and want to know what's the risk of having another child who's asthmatic, or one of them has been asthmatic. And the answer to that is about what the empiric risk for having a child with asthma in that situation is about 1 in 8.
Yes, sir.
Yes, back to Down syndrome again.
Yeah.
Traditionally, Down syndrome has been associated with maternal age, but I've noticed some recent references in which it's also been associated with paternal age.
Mm-hmm.
Is this true of other chromosomal non-disjunctions as well? And to what extent is it true? And is the research that's being done confirmed in this?
The question was, Down syndrome is associated with increasing maternal age. Is it also associated with increasing paternal age? And is it true of other trisomies as well?
Non-disjunction.
Yeah. Now, it's very difficult to get a large sample of fathers who are of increasing age unless the mothers are also of increasing age. So if you get a sample of 48-year-old dads, mostly the mums are 42, so that it's difficult to collect a large sample. However, that has been done in so that they're trying to control for the age of the mother, so that what is being looked at is actually the effect of the increasing age of the father, and it seems to have a small effect. There was another report out just in this last month, I think, in the American Journal of Medical Genetics or Human Genetics, and they had just done another study in Atlanta and found a small effect. If there is an effect of paternal age, there appears to be one, but it appears to be fairly small. If you look at children with Down syndrome and they have markers that you can determine which parent the extra chromosome came from, in probably somewhere around 20%, it's from the father. So it's not just simply mum doing this.
Yes, sir.
At what stages in the development of the fetus is radiation critical?
Well, at what stages in the development of the fetus is radiation critical? In the pre-implantation period, that's before it implants, it doesn't seem to make very much difference because it seems to be protected. After that, it's very vulnerable in the early period of organogenesis, and you seem to get a lot of loss. It seems that if there's enough radiation to cause damage, you get loss. Later on, after several weeks' development, the things that you see are microcephaly. Very often, it seems that if there's enough radiation to cause damage, it often is, of other kinds, it's often lost. The things that you see most often are microcephaly. But it theoretically is not, the early fast-growing is the most vulnerable.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Where this information, the question was about the genetic input to schizophrenia, and where the evidence that there's an important genetic input to schizophrenia has come from is from a couple of sources. One is looking at the data on monozygotic twins as opposed to dizygotic twins. Now, monozygotic twins are genetically the same individual. They're genetically the same. They just happen to split into two people very early on. If you look at the incidence of schizophrenia in them, it's quite, given that one twin has it, it's very high that they're concordant. If you look at dizygotic twins who are raised in the same uterus, raised in the same family, but they're genetically different, they're only as alike as brother and sister, then you find a much lower incidence of schizophrenia. Also, there's some very elegant studies of Seymour Ketty and others that have been done in Scandinavia where they have taken the offspring of schizophrenics who are adopted out to biologically normal people and looked at the incidence of schizophrenia in those children and looked at the incidence of schizophrenia in the offspring of those children, the biological children. And it seems that where your genes come from make a lot more difference than where you're raised.
Yes, sir.
Yes, it applies basically. Was the question about smoking and drinking applying to fathers as well as mothers? Well, you'd have to postulate there that smoking and drinking would have some effect on the gamete. There actually was an interesting preliminary paper out suggesting that smoking did have some effect. Smoking in the fathers did have some effect, but there's not very much hard data.
Yes, way at the back there.
Yes, it is. I'm not quite sure what it would... The question was, she has... two cousins, two nieces, who have a sensitivity to light. Are they very fair?
Yes. I think they have a lot of problems because they don't think they want to go through
the light. She says that the parents of these children are related to each other, they're consanguinous. The thing is, she asked what it might be. Well, obviously, one of the things it could be would be albinism, but I wouldn't know. Albinism is a condition where people don't have the enzyme tyrosinase, so they're not able to process and make pigment, so that their hair is fair. And the important thing, though, is that they don't have the right normal amount of pigment in the eye. Therefore, they can't see properly in the macular area, and they have a searching nystagmus, and they usually have very poor central vision. So that's not what it is. I don't know what it is. However... Okay. There's two types of albinism, actually, type 1 and type 2. And in one, the enzyme defect isn't complete, so those people do form some pigment, and as they get older, they do have some yellow deposits in their hair, but I'm not sure what they have, but the interesting thing that you make the comment is that parents are related, therefore could it be genetic? And as we went through in recessive, if you have a rare gene, the most likely place you're to find the same rare gene would be in relatives. So that when you're looking at recessive disorders, the rarer the recessive disorder is, the more likely you are to find that those parents of that child who is affected are related to each other. Because if a disorder is excessively rare, say 1 in 100,000 population, the carrier rate may be 1 in 170 or 1 in 200. The chances of that coming up would be very small unless you married a relative. So that's why we see that, and it's if the parents are consanguineous, it's likely to be genetic.
Two more questions. Yes, Matt.
Could you tell us what causes
heart defects
in newborns? Heart defects in newborns can be part of chromosomal syndromes, They can be part of a dominant syndrome, they can be part of a recessive syndrome, and they can be X-linked. They can also be the most common kind, and we're talking about a fairly common thing there. Congenital heart disease occurs probably in about 1% of the pediatric population. So the majority of those are not associated with single gene things like I went through and talked about, although a proportion are. The majority are multifactorially inherited and fit into the last category I talked about, where you can give an empiric recurrence risk, which usually is of the order of a few percent. Depends. For something like VSD, it may be 4 or 5%. For something rarer like tetralogy of Fallot, it may be 2 to 3%. Oh yes, it could. I mean, there are a whole multitude of things that congenital heart disease can be associated with. It can be associated with having taken some kind of teratogen or with a viral infection such as a rubella.
can you repeat that?
two of the Huxleys were discussing together why they were so brilliant and marvelous and well endowed, and one of them said to the other, "Well, it must be our blue genes." I think that's a great note to end on.
Well, I promised this gentleman a question. Yeah.
Sure. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. I think that obviously genes can have a role. Something as complex as that is certainly not single gene determined. But any particular category of disorder can have a genetic input, and I'm sure that it will come out that there may be some genetic background to some of the cases.
And I'd ask Dr. Dennis Vance, Associate Dean of Medicine, to thank Dr. Baird on our behalf.
Ladies and gentlemen, you've all heard we are what we eat. Tonight, I think you've heard it's much more important we are what we inherited. Dr. Baird has undertaken a very difficult task to explain her complex discipline to an audience such as the Vancouver Institute, and she has succeeded admirably. She has given us a basic lesson in genetics. She has told us about some of the severe and common genetic diseases that occur in British Columbia, and she has told us what the medical genetics discipline can do for the people of British Columbia. She has done this in an excellent, well-organized lecture of the very highest caliber. I think, ladies and gentlemen, you can see why we in the Faculty of Medicine are extremely pleased to have her as the head of our Department of Medical Genetics. And on behalf of the audience, I'd like to extend our sincere thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Vance. Next week, same time, same station, we have Professor Eugene Wigner from Princeton University speaking on Einstein, the man and his work. This is the Einstein centenary. And you all saw the commercial on the screen beforehand. I think we're running a good series. Please, if you're that interested, go and join. Membership that you join now goes right through the year. Many thanks for coming. We'll see you next week.